Chapter 54. The skimmer ride from Big Jasper to Azulay showed Tia how fast this war was changing the world. Like many great discoveries, Gavin Gall's insight was simply in retrospect. Instead of taking the oar as his paradigm or the sail, he took the wind itself. The skimmers were powered by drafters who shot unfocused lux in to propel them. But Andros Gael had seized on his son's original insight and innovated upon it, realizing that the new technology had a cultural implication, the typical threshold by which a satrapy justified the cost of educating a drafter at the Chromeria was her ability to make a solid, stable luxin in one or more colours. What Andros was the first to realize was that the reedsman didn't need to draft stable luxin, so he'd called up all the discipulae who'd fallen out of the Chromeria in the last 4 decades. Hundreds of suitable candidates had been found already. Thus he gained an entire corps for transportation and saved the halos and lives of his trained drafters for war. 4 of those now powered the ultralight skimmer that propelled Tia, the messenger, and barely more than the clothes on their backs across the sea to Perea. But they made it in a day and a half. Gavin Gall was rumoured to have been able to go twice as far in a single morning, but Gavin was also rumoured now to have been 10 feet tall, to have ended wars with a word, and to have been able to draft black and white luxin both. Gavin was said to have had a shining mien that made men gape and maidens swoon. The mien part was basically true, but still, though Tia would admit he was a man the likes of which the world would never see again, he wasn't a god. They also said now that he was going to come back to the 7 satrapies in their hour of greatest need to save them all. Would have been better if he hadn't left us in our hour of greatest need, Tia thought. He was dead now. As like as not, the Order itself had killed him. He was simply too powerful and unpredictable for them to tolerate. All too soon, Tia and the messenger, a senior diplomat named Anjali Gates, were in sight of Azulay. Tia tried to get all her gawking out of the way before they docked, but the grandeur of the city defied dismissal. Their first glimpse was of the lighthouse called the Sword of Heaven. Its red glass dome gleamed in the sun like a ruby set in its pommel. Walkways made the hilt, and the body of the lighthouse made a blade, its point buried in the earth. From the ground up, the first 10 paces were blank grey stone like steel. Above that, the stone was whitewashed, and above that, beaten gold had been laid over the stone into flames, as if fire were emanating from the hilt down the blade. "You should see it on Sunday," Anjali Gates said, coming to stand next to Tia. "The pyroturgs here make wonders to rival the Jaspers. It's why I joined the diplomatic corps. I wanted to see all the wonders of this world." She fell silent, and Tia asked, "And have you?" Anjali grinned. "Well, I've not seen the City of Stone in the Cracked Lands, but no one else has either for at least 400 years. As for the rest, mostly. From the Everdark Gates to the Melos Deeps, from the Ruth Delta in flood to the floating city. I've seen the colossi of the Iron Elephants above the Red Cliffs, and the 4 ladies of Garriston at sunset, and I've seen a sea demon circling White Mist Reef. I've played 9 kings with sat traps and danced a gorkle with one of the last pygmy chiefs."
"Really?" Tia asked.
"Really. We diplomats often stretch the truth and sometimes make what we say seem to be the opposite of what we're actually saying, but we do our best not to lie straight out." Anjali smiled. "Well, at least that's the Chromeria's school of thinking. Other nations, satrapies, and even clans have other approaches.
You just go from wonder to wonder. Nice work if you can get it, huh?" Tia said.
"Oh, don't get me wrong. Most of my work has been much more tedious. It took me a full year to negotiate the passage taxes the Arbornians charge on the Narrows, 1 year working for an agreement that only lasts 10. Though naturally one flatters oneself that the representatives will simply renew it when it expires 4 years from now, if the satrapies last so long."
"How'd you get to see all those things, though?
You don't even look that old."
Sorry.
Anjali grinned. "Easy. I gave myself all the interesting assignments."
"You what? Wait, how senior are you?" Tia asked.
"Ambassadorships are given out to friends of satraps and colours. They're not quite sinecures, but they are largely ceremonial positions.
Important for what they do, of course, but there are entire armies of people like me, the career diplomats, not the political appointees, who get the work done where the satrapies rub each other wrong. Fishing rights, piracy, extradition of criminals and runaway slaves, water rights, taxes, spot checks of compliance to the slave laws, and, of course, these days, communicating and compliance checks of the new balancing dictates.
The new laws governing drafting that Promarchos, Guile, and the Spectrum had instituted didn't apply to drafters training for war, so Tyr hadn't even noticed them. Drafters elsewhere, however, had to compensate for the war effort, not drafting a certain colour as news of light storms came into the Cremeria, or trying to draft more of its opposite colour.
"I imagine that's a nuisance," Tyr said.
She was still studying the city they were rapidly approaching. Azulay was built on a steep hill down to the sea after the arm of its protected bay and the lighthouse. Buildings were packed, literally against each other, sharing walls up to 4 and 5 stories, and red brick roofs differentiated from their neighbours only by their individual bright pastel walls. Ivies and greenery of all sorts sprouted everywhere.
"A nuisance? You have no idea, do you?" Anjali Gates said. "In the rich cities like Big Jasper, sure, drafters still use magic for entertainment and convenience, but in the villages where most people live, a ban on green in the fall might damage the olive harvest, or mean only natural fertilizers can be used with the barley and wheat plantings. Subred is chronically restricted, so if the weather turns bad, an entire grape harvest might be ruined. Worse, it means a new mother with a fever can't be cooled.
A nuisance? Child, people are dying so your compatriots can train with fire." Tyr swallowed. She'd not even considered it.
"On the plus side, there haven't been as many light storms since the rules were instituted, and no reports of bane in months, of course."
Or Holland's ball sweat. But Tyr said, "You never answered me, did you? About your position?"
"Oh, did I not?"
But Anjali Gates smirked.
"I'm the Corregidor Emeritus of the Diplomatic Corps."
"That means you were the boss, but you retired?" Tyr said.
"Unretired now, briefly. They needed someone who had a chance of reasoning with the mercurial Nukaba, and someone expendable in case she does to me what has been done to messengers bearing unwelcome news from time immemorial."
"Tough assignment," Tyr said.
"I volunteered."
"I didn't," Tyr grasped.
"I know. That's why I brought it up."
"What do you mean you brought it up? I asked you out of the blue."
"Did you? Regardless, if they seize me, you shall get the hell out. If they take me, they'll either kill me outright, or possibly do something to shame me, send me back naked, or shave my head, or rape me. Each has its own word in the language of diplomacy. The Cromeria will respond appropriately as it finds possible."
What the hell does that even mean?" Tyr asked.
"If the Cromeria were to later seize the Nukaba alive, then if she has beheaded me without torture, she would be beheaded in turn. If she sends me back naked, she would likewise be paraded through the streets. If I were to be raped on her orders, she would be tortured horribly and shamed publicly as much as possible, though not raped, of course. We aren't animals. Most leaders have an intuitive understanding of this kind of graduated retribution, if not an explicit one. Of course, how she conducts herself in the intervening time between my death and her reckoning could negate or change all of this."
"And you volunteered?" Tyr asked.
"I'm old," Anjali said cheerfully. "After negotiating grain prices and cart widths hundreds of times, believe me, this is the kind of message we and the diplomatic corps dream of delivering. If only we can get away with it. But it also takes a certain gravitas to deliver a proper epistolary beating. If I pull this off, I'll have to award myself the corps' highest honour. If I don't, I've left orders that they should award it to me posthumously."
She grinned at Tyr.
"What's an epistolary beating?" "Watch the introduction. You'll see what I mean. Just because I know the ceremonial bows and the 27 titles of the Nukaba Haruru doesn't mean I like reciting them. You realize you're part of this diplomatic grammar, right?"
"Huh?"
"One blackguard accompanying me, not two, and the one they send is petite. Forgive me for stating what others will think. I do not share this judgment, and in fact know your reputation well, but the Nukaba will see you as a little girl. Your slight stature makes you look even younger than you are. She might not even believe that you're a blackguard. The Cromeria sending you to accompany me is a small snub, but it also means they're less likely to take or kill you. They'll think you're some child put into this role, and whatever glory they might find in defeating or humiliating a big man blackguard is therefore absent. My presence itself is an insult. And that's supposed to make me feel better? Tia asked. I'm trying to help you gauge and define your own scope of actions here. This isn't my assignment alone, it's ours. You really think we can reel them back in? Tia asked. She hadn't meant to ask a real question. She knew what she had to do here. I think diplomacy may resolve all conflicts between parties of goodwill. That last bit is the part that bites you in the arse, isn't it? Rather, it's the part that bites you in the arse, my young blackguard friend, for where there's no goodwill, my job ends. Tia had thought for a moment that they were very different indeed, and Jali, the happy talker, travelling through the satrapies, her words bringing life and peace wherever she went, soothing conflict and finding outcomes acceptable to all parties, Tia the shield that came down on stiff necks. But perhaps they were simply two different horses, pulling the same chariot of state. Anjali, at the front, saw different scenery wherever she went. Tia, pulling behind her, saw only horses' asses and different kinds of roads. They passed under the very shadow of the lighthouse, the reedsmen artfully guiding their small craft between the hundreds of ships going in and out of the port. They headed straight into the small beach, threw cloths over the skimmer so as to keep its secrets from the curious, and then threw down a plank. Tia put on blue spectacles and trotted down the plank first. People began pushing closer on the crowded beach to get a look at them, so Tia threw her cloak back off her shoulders to reveal the sword and pistols at her belt, and the rope spear wrapped around her waist, its long blade hanging down one thigh like another sword. The crowd backed off. But Tia and Anjali didn't even make it off the beach before they were stopped by a detachment of port guards. Evidently, the oddity that was the skimmer speeding across the waves had elicited some alarm. Anjali Gates did all the talking, declaring them to be a delegation from the Cromeria and demanding the skimmer and their men be unmolested while they themselves should be accompanied to a satrapa's palace. While the diplomats spoke, Tia did her best to look imposing without being threatening. It was doubly hard with her feet sunk into the sand while the port guards stood on the paving stones of the street just above them. Tia felt about as tall as Celia Green. No wonder Buskin had worn those shoes. Tia would give her second favourite rope spear right now to be a little taller. In short order, though, they found themselves being escorted through the streets. Tia wished that they could take their time in the city itself. Steep, cobbled streets led up to a plateau where the majority of the city rested and ivy adorned every building. Where the ivies or wisteria had torn apart stone or lumber, the people had simply rebuilt around them, rather than trimming them back, even building supports to prop up ancient vines. Every window was a riot of flowering plants as well. The pastel paints were fresh and bright. And the people. Ah, the people. Azulay was as cosmopolitan as any of the other great cities of the seven satrapies, but here the many skin tones of the satrapies' ethnicities were painted on a background of many Parians. It made Tia feel oddly at home, and she realized only slowly that it was because she didn't feel odd. In Big Jasper she hadn't stood out, simply because everyone stood out. But this was different. Homey. She wasn't able to enjoy it or explore any of the little alleys, though, each one adorned with murals, it seemed, or visit the little kopi counters or the kitchens wafting heavenly smells into the street. A great wide ribbon of less steep grand boulevard switchbacked up the great hill so wagons could make their way to and from the port, but the guards took them straight up, sometimes climbing steep stairs, muscling aside burnous-clad crowds when necessary. Some kind of palace guards joined them halfway up, and at the doors of the palace grounds, four of the Nukaba's personal guard, the drafting Tafok Amagers, fell in around them. Dressed in white and black, with blue vests, the colour of the sky, the sun guards claimed their genesis from Lucidonius's first followers and personal guard, but the only thing relevant about them for Tia was that these were the men who'd helped blind Gavin and tried to kill Carus and Ironfist and Essel and Ben-Hadad. They had killed Hezik. He'd been a jovial braggart, and Tia hadn't known him well, but he was their brother, and she would never forgive his killers. Carus had sneered about the Tafok Amagez's magical abilities, calling them blunt drafters who lacked all subtlety, but no one had criticized their fighting abilities, and Tia saw that they held themselves like professionals. Tia realized that if she hadn't come as an assassin, Her role here would be entirely ornamental. If the Pareans decided to kill her, she would be lucky if she took down even one before they got her. So she pulled her cloak back around herself. It's a bad idea to poke a lion in a cage. These lions weren't caged. When they entered the grand doors of the palace itself, Tyr almost missed a step. Soaring ceilings, white marble, black marble, flying staircases, stained glass-filled clerestories, jewels and onyx, and a giant statue that seemed to be made entirely of obsidian and gold, standing on powerful legs, wearing what Tyr thought was called a toga, reaching toward the sky, the sun, with yearning and with determination in his clenched jaws. Anjali Gates saw Tyr's astonishment. At the midwinter feasts, the pyroturges remove the pinnacle cap of the dome and lower an incendiary. All night long he reaches for a burning sun, and these stained glass windows shine light out for leagues for everyone to see all through the year's longest night. Inside there is one hell of an all-night party. She smiled at a memory. He is known as Handros or Holom, the seeker after the Lord of Light, or perhaps the striver after Orholam, or less popularly, he who strives with Orholam. With as in with, or with as in against? Tyr asked. Indeed. I think I lost you there, Tyr said as they ascended a staircase with no railing or visible supports. The grammar allows for either interpretation, but these are pious people. It is best not to note aloud that while their people were the first to fight with Lucidonius, they were also the first to fight with Lucidonius. Ah, Tyr said. A subtle tongue, it is, old Parian, so contextual, and we don't possess so much of that context any more. The scholars even say that instead of Handros or Olam, it may actually be Handros Olam, which would make it the seeker after the hidden, or he who strives with or against the hidden, Tyr guessed. Indeed, Anjali said. Handros. Isn't that the same root name as Andros? It is. The Guile family has deep roots here in Perea. By chance or design, they arrived while Satrapa Asmith was holding court. More palace guards in white and black stopped them at the court. Weapons? Any other contraband? Dangerous items? A young man asked. Anjali Gates handed over a belt knife and was given a chit with which to reclaim it. Tyr just stared at the man. She threw back her cloak. I'm a blackguard, Kerr. By ancient rites and treaties, we go unarmed nowhere. Our right holds in the presence of colours and satraps and the prism himself. The man gulped and shot a look at the Tafok Amagers. I'm commanded to let no one... We are here with an emergency message from the Promarchos and the White and the entire spectrum, Anjali said. Young man, Orholam help you if you detain us. The fate of the satrapies themselves rests upon a speedy response from your people. One of the Tafok Amagers interrupted.
Oh, quit this. We can handle one little girl, whatever they dress her in.
One little girl? Tyr knew she should feel good they'd said it. She was supposed to be underestimated. So it was working. But fuck them. The guard had the Tafok Amagers sign for her and then let them pass. They opened a small door inset in the great hall doors. The great hall was a variation on the entry's theme, several stories tall, stained glass in clear stories, flying buttresses, and here silver and ebony and teak and walnut woods with mirrors that beamed diffuse sunlight to the platform. The four Tafok Amagers and an equal number of palace guards took them to a line at least 100 supplicants long and stopped at the back of it. Tyr could barely see the Nukaba and the Satrapa from here. The Nukaba sat at the Satrapa's right hand, or perhaps the Satrapa sat at her left. Their chairs were of almost an equal height, the Nukaba's a smidgen lower, but significantly grander. Anjali Gates held herself at peace. When it took another 10 minutes for the Nukaba and the Satrapa to finish with one case, the details of which Tyr couldn't even hear, the diplomat put on her violet-tinged spectacles. It hadn't even occurred to Tyr that the woman was a super-violet drafter. Of course she was. As soon as a chamberlain brought down his iron-capped staff onto the floor, causing a bang that Tyr assumed meant judgment had been rendered, Anjali was out of her place in line like a shot. Somehow she moved quickly, without appearing to hurry, and she was 10 paces down the main aisle before even Tyr moved. An instant later, the Tafok Amagers woke up and poured out after them. Anjali pulled a small orb from a pocket and twisted it. She held it above her head as she continued to walk, and in an instant it bloomed and then burnt an intense yellow.
"Blessed Nukaba, exalted Satrapa Azmith, I come from the Chromaria. This is my proof,"
Anjali boomed, just as Tyr and the Tefok Amages caught up with her.
"I come with an emergency message from the Promarchos himself and the White's own pen for the entire spectrum."
The spectacle, and Anjali's confidence, was enough to buy them time to get to the front of the room. But there a rank of Tefok Amages had deployed, spears levelled, blocking their path to the platform. Anjali Gates stopped and held out the beacon toward the commander of the Tefok Amages facing her.
"For your inspection,"
she promptly ignored him. Satrapa Azmith conferred with the Nukaba. She had the dark, dark skin of a mountain Parian, with long, narrow limbs adorned with gold and turquoise bands. She wore a transparent black veil trimmed in gold and a flowing black burnous with black embroidered squares interlocking. A jug of wine sat on the table at her left hand for her to serve herself. She said,
"We have not seen the Western Star beacon in these lands for decades. You're lucky the Amages didn't skewer you." "Such a fear didn't even occur to me. We are all loyal children of Orholam here and brothers and sisters under the light,"
Anjali said. She might have stressed the word loyal just a little. The Satrapa and the Nukaba spoke again, and Tyr was stunned by the Nukaba's glamour. Where the Satrapa was modest and sedate, the Nukaba looked more like a pagan priestess, oozing sensuality and demanding attention, than a servant of Orholam humbly directing attention up toward the Lord of Light. Of course, Gavin Guile had certainly had more than a little smouldering sensuality himself when he wanted to, and Tyr had heard women getting themselves worked up just talking about how he'd looked during Sunday festivities past, where he'd gone more than half naked. So maybe it wasn't any different. But it felt different. For a moment, Tyr forgot her training and took in all the jewels, the perfectly tailored dress that emphasized the woman's enviable curves, and the gold and ochre and coal face paints highlighting her eyes, and the tattoo under each, judgment under the left and mercy under the right. But then she remembered herself and looked not to outer things, but as a blackguard looking at a potential opponent. The hauteur overlaid physical weakness. Her upper arms were flabby. There was a loose puffiness in her face that spoke either of overindulgence last night or of chronic overindulgence. Her eyes were glassy, as if she'd been enjoying ratweed this morning. Her attitude was insolent. In short, though the Nukaba had to be in her mid-30s, she reminded Tyr of a blackguard nunk who needed a good ass-kicking. The Nukaba waved lazily at her Tafok Amages to withdraw. All of them were eyeing Tia's many weapons, glancing back only occasionally, so none of them happened to be looking at her when she gave the gesture. A look of sudden rage at being ignored washed over the Nukaba's face, and she snapped her fingers, not just once, but twice, as if they were dogs. All of them looked back at her. All of them. The men weren't fools or amateurs, so it spoke to Tyr of how horribly the Nukaba must treat them. When the Nukaba wanted their attention, she demanded all of it. It was stupid. If Tyr were an assassin, it would have given her ample time to draw her flintlock pistol and... oh, shit. She was an assassin. Just not that kind. The Nukaba slashed her hand, and the men pulled back instantly. Still, their commander gave orders, and as Tyr and Anjali took several more steps forward, Tyr saw that two Tefok Amages quietly lit slow matches and affixed them to muskets. The others were already filled with their colours, and Tyr realized that the front of the great hall was covered in a pristine white rug that had to be there so that the bespectacled Tefok Amages could draft as quickly as possible. One parol drafter. If there's just one parol drafter here, I'm in big trouble. The Nukaba was studying them, and apparently it was good manners not to speak until given permission, because Anjali Gates held her tongue as if happy to wait all day. Tyr had slightly more trouble doing so when the Nukaba looked at her and openly sneered. Apparently she saw only a little girl too. Again, it should have felt good. Again, it didn't. The Nukaba turned to Satrapa Azmith, but spoke loudly enough for all to hear.
"Do you know, back when my brothers joined the Black Guard, it was a revered body. In fact, to get in, I think you actually had to have reached puberty."
The Satrapa chuckled, and the front rows laughed like sycophants. Tia had to take deep breaths. A black guard guards her tongue. This was exactly what she wanted, right? To be overlooked by these disrespectful pieces of easy tea. A black guard guards her tongue. The Nukaba harumphed and turned to the satrapa again, this time more quietly asking a question about the star beacon. She asked a few other questions, and Tia was able to get enough of a grip on her temper to see how clever it was to have the satrapa be the Nukaba's spymaster. Everyone knew that Tilaeli Azmuth was a figurehead, so they would take the Nukaba's speaking with her to be merely keeping up appearances. The satrapa would daily meet with dozens of the most important people in the satrapy and beyond, but would be underestimated if not dismissed. Tia guessed that the big jug of wine was intended to further lower her in people's estimation. She feigned drunkenness while the Nukaba concealed her real drunkenness. The woman hid in plain sight. And dear Orholm, Tia was supposed to kill her. "Please," the satrapa said, "do deliver our dear White's message."
"Then please forgive my informality," Anjali Gates said. "I deliver this message exactly as instructed in the White's voice."
She drew herself more erect and imperious, and Tia read it herself. Carissa told her that her time to strike the satrapa might be during the very first paragraphs of her message. She'd said that the satrapa might find them so infuriating that if she went into seizures or had a heart attack, no one would be surprised. While keeping her arms carefully motionless and down at her sides, Tia readied peril in her fingertips. She hadn't had time to scope out every one of the Tafok Amages. One of them might be a peril drafter. If so, Tia was about to sign her own death warrant. Beside her, Anjali's voice took on the cadence of Caris's own as she delivered the White's message.
"Tilaeli, you're useless. If you'd fulfilled your duties as satrapa with a modicum of competence, I'd be addressing this letter to you. You haven't, so I'll not keep up the pretense that you matter. Further, in our hope of someday working with a representative who possesses a spine, by unanimous vote, the spectrum hereby strips you of the rights and privileges of a satrapa. We will eagerly await whichever successor the Nukaba names for you, and address this letter to her instead."
Tia had her eyes locked on the satrapa. The woman looked as if she'd been run over by a charging horse. But her face didn't go to rage. Tia hesitated. Anjali Gates continued unperturbed in the sudden, utter silence in the great hall. She turned to the Nukaba.
"Haruru, let me be blunt. You wounded my husband and tried to kill me. As a woman, I despise you and hate what you've done. No doubt you hate me as well. But I speak to you today not as a wife, but as a woman entrusted to care for the drafters of the seven satrapies, even as you have been entrusted to care for the believers of Paria and beyond, and to guard the legacy of the Lucidonius. We are greater than our quarrel, and we would besmirch our offices and indeed our very faith if we were to brawl like tavern wenches who might only upset tables and feelings. So I put our personal quarrel behind us and trust you will do the same."
The Nukaba had slowly been rising from her chair as Anjali spoke. For a moment Tia thought that the Nukaba was going to bolt out of her throne and attack the diplomat with fists and fingernails. If she did, should Tia fight her off? She was already calculating how to make sure that the Nukaba was between her and the musketeers if it came to that, when Satrapa Azmuth grabbed the Nukaba's arm and pulled her back to her seat. The satrapa had a slow temper. Shit. That meant Tia couldn't take this opportunity to assassinate her. Anjali continued her message placidly, but Tia could tell that the mad woman was enjoying the hell out of this.
"That said, we have not the luxury of time to continue overtures and negotiations and stalling and games. The seven satrapies are at war. We need you, Haruru. We need Paria wholeheartedly with us. Without your soldiers, the seven satrapies will fall. You think you have three choices. One, helping us and losing many of your men. Two, joining the Colour Prince and possibly being rewarded greatly at the cost of violating your oaths and inviting civil war with those still loyal to us. Or three, waiting as long as possible, hoping that we slaughter each other, and then coming in at the end and ending up in a better position than either, and maybe setting up your own empire."
To see the cynicism and disloyalty of those calculations laid out so nakedly took the breath of many in the great hall. Even those jaded enough to have read the tea leaves in what the Nukaba was doing were shocked to have someone actually say it publicly. Tyr saw then that Caris White's power was in speaking openly what others trusted everyone would hide. This is the game, others thought. Caris said, I see your game, and no. Anjali said, if you thought those were your choices, you were wrong. I'm not giving you those options. The Colour Prince will destroy the Chromeria utterly without you. You owe us your loyalty. We ask for nothing that doesn't already belong to us, so if we are to die, you will die too. I will leave my back exposed to the Colour Prince, knowing it will mean the loss of the Jaspers and the Chromeria, and I will sail all of my soldiers to your home, and all my drafters who train for war even now. When we arrive, we will kill everyone who joins you in treason. We will enslave the families of all those disloyal to us and give their lands and houses and titles to those of our friends who remember their oaths. Under such circumstances, and with such promised consequences, how many of your men will join you in treason? Even if all of them do, the Chromeria still has power enough to destroy you. We will, utterly. This we swear. And then we will attempt to colonize Paria and hold our defense against the Colour Prince in our mountains. This strategy will likely mean our death. We are willing to risk it. For us, it is a likely death against a certain one. Now, blessed under the light, guardian of truth, arbiter of mercy, holy Nukaba, your choice is simple. Fight us or delay us and certainly die, or join us and likely die. Signed, Orholam's humble servants, the Iron White, Promarchos Andros Gael, and the Holy Spectrum of the Seven Satrapies.